genetic engineering, and I'm going to lead off on this, and I'm not a geneticist and I'm not an engineer, but I learned from Luther and Ruth Mons and her brokering and a few other people to sin boldly, and so that's what's going to happen today. I think there is something happening these mornings in terms of structure. Some of you may have just come in this morning. Some of you may have been with us Thursday and Friday. Dave is a civil engineer. I am a theologian. And we've been trying to talk about some things together. And on Thursday, we had a topic, Faith and Doubt in Science and Religion. And we shared that presentation equally because each of us thinks that both faith and doubt are important categories for both science and, let's say, Christianity now. And so we talked about that a little bit. Yesterday, we moved kind of from theological concerns into primarily ethical concerns, and the topic was making good mistakes and being good sinners. And again, we shared that presentation time equally. And if you were here, you remember Dave talked about making good mistakes, and he said he wasn't going to use any church language. And I talked about being good sinners, and I certainly didn't use any engineering language. But I think that we thought, at least, that we were saying pretty much the same thing. And so we had some conversation about that. Today, we're moving into a very specific topic, and the topic is genetic engineering. And for a number of reasons, I am taking the main responsibility for the initial presentation. That is that's a little bit strange because Dave is the engineer. I'm not. On the other hand, I've read more about genetic engineering than Dave has. I can't digest it and assimilate it as well, I'm sure, but I think that by the format, by me making the presentation, I think we want to say that Christianity has something to do with wholeness. It has something to do with the creation as well as redemption, and that it's necessary for the body of Christ and its many members to somehow function together. So it's okay with Dave, at least. I hope it's okay with you that I take the initial responsibility for this presentation. And it may be that come Monday, if we're working together again, that Dave may take the initial responsibility for a theological topic. In fact, he was talking to me the other day about wind and spirit and had all kinds of theological things going about that. And I said, well, gee, I've never thought much about that. And so maybe I'm giving a scientific presentation today and David's going to give a theological one on Monday. Maybe. We haven't talked about that yet.
That's a good idea.
Well, that's possible. Okay. So you know that this is experimental. You know that I'm in no way any kind of expert on this. Holden is a place where some risks can be taken. Fred here is a medical doctor, and maybe some of the rest of you are. Maybe there's a geneticist here. Maybe there's a DNA research person here. There are certainly people who know more about biology than I do. Well, let me try to get something out. Dave will make some kind of response. We'll have some conversation. There has been a shift, apparently, at least in the stuff that I've read. Many people are saying this. There has been a shift in the focus of concern from physics to biology. I have a good friend who's my age who teaches at the University of Wisconsin. He's a nuclear physicist. Visited him last summer, and he was kind of moping around. This is an opinion from one person, but he said physics is over. Physics is finished. Nobody's interested in physics anymore. If someone comes to me and wants to study physics, I tell them, maybe you could spend your time better some other way. No one would have said that in the 50s, right? No one. there is a massive shift from the nuclear physicist to the molecular biologist. And the societal, the social, the ecological concerns are much more focused on molecular biology than they are on nuclear physics. They are much more focused on genetic engineering than they are on certainly on the hydrogen or the atom bomb, although obviously that continues in nuclear energy concerns, etc. Okay. The focus of that concern is in a technology called recombinant DNA technology. I'm going to have to talk a little bit about that. And it is very new. It starts maybe 1971. But it has broken on the public, into the public arena in a massive way just in this year. This year. Now, just as an illustration of that fact, both Harper's and Atlantic Monthly ran feature centerfold articles on recombinant DNA technology in February. That can't be an accident. Those people must telephone one another, like Time and Newsweek people must telephone one another, because the issues very often parallel one another. February, both Atlantic Monthly and Harper's centerfold major articles on recombinant DNA research. Time ran a cover story on it April 18th. The Hastings Center Report, which is a journal which comes out of the Hastings Center in New York, which is one of two major biomedical ethical centers in the country. The other one is at Georgetown University, the Kennedy Institute in Washington, D.C. In April, the Hastings Center came out with a feature on recombinant DNA research, including three separate articles. Sojourner, some of you know that magazine, came out with an article on it in May. The Smithsonian, some of you get that, is a very slick, marvelous magazine that comes out of the Smithsonian Institution, ran a major article on it in June. Scientific American ran a major article on it in July. Even the Saturday Evening Post in the September issue with Farrah Fawcett Majors on the cover had the first of its 16 articles on recombinant DNA research. The title was The Gene Scene, and it was written by Isaac Asimov, whom some of you know is one of the major science writers in the United States. So it's a very, very new thing, and it's very public, and it's very big, okay? It is big not only in terms of information dissemination, but it is very big in terms of public policy. Back in, like, I think 1973, Senator Edward Kennedy of the Senate HEW Committee, or whatever that's called, started hearings on recombinant DNA research. And he has a bill now before Congress. There's another bill before Congress from the House. Those did not get acted on because Congress adjourned, but they will be acted on this fall, and I'm sure that there will be a lot of stuff in the newspapers and the magazines about those congressional bills. So that's a very new concern, and it's a very public policy kind of concern. Let me try to say a few words about what recombinant DNA research is. And then I'd like to say something about the way in which scientists are responding to that phenomenon, and maybe mention some ethical issues and possibly some theological issues. It's going to take a little while to try to do that. If I go very, very simply, that's to try to get it fixed in my own head, okay? I know that many of you know a lot more about this than I. In reading about this, I had to go back and try to get straight in my own mind some very fundamental things. I had to go back and read what an atom was, and that's a basic unit. And there are protons, there are neutrons, and there's an orbit of electrons. An atom is not a piece of stuff. It is a movement of electrical charges. And atoms have electrons moving in their outer orbit, and when somehow or another they share an electron in their outer orbit, those atoms become a molecule. And there are some extremely simple molecules. H2O, water molecule, is very simple. When you start getting into molecules that contain carbon, they get to be immensely more complicated, and nitrogen, and molecules that have to do with life become incredibly complicated. DNA is a molecule. DNA is a molecule, and it's deoxyribonucleic acid, is what that stands for, and that there is also RNA, which is ribonucleic acid, and RNA comes from the fact that RNA comes from ribo sugar, and deoxyribonucleic acid, the name comes from the fact that it comes from some other kind of sugar. Okay. DNA is a molecule. It's an incredibly complex molecule, and it was first hypothesized, that is, it was thought up by James Watson, a fellow by the name of Crick, in Cambridge, England, in 1953. There have been all kinds of previous research in genetics, going back to Gregor Mendel, the Augustinian monk who 100 years ago, 1854, began working with peas in his garden and counting the wrinkled and the smooth skins and the green and the white and all this business. He published his paper in 1865, laying down the essential laws of heredity, and most of you know something about that, but there was no hardcore experimental base for it. It was a kind of a statistical hypothesis, and people didn't pay much attention to that. It was not until 1953 at Cambridge that James Watson, who was 25 years old at the time, he was an American. He was over in Copenhagen, I think, on some kind of a grant. And after he was there for a few months, he said that he didn't want to work on that anymore. He wanted to go to Cambridge and work with Crick on DNA. And the granting people said, nuts to you. And Watson said, nuts to you, too. He went anyway. He got some money from another funding agency. And they spent about a year not doing research, but sitting and thinking. Reading the literature and cutting strips of paper and stuff and modeling options, and they came to the idea that the DNA molecule was what they call the double helix. And a helix is, I guess, if you take a strip of paper and simply twist it like this, like a winding staircase, that's a helix, and the DNA molecule is a double helix, with all kinds of connections between. So they published that paper. Later on, it was established in the laboratory that they were essentially correct, and a whole new era began in 1953. We're now like 20 years later. DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, is a molecule. It is the essential stuff of which genes are made. Okay, a gene is the smallest unit of hereditary information, and a gene is made up of DNA molecules. The human body has hundreds of thousands of genes, and each one of those genes is a code for some specific trait. People know very little about that. Very few genes have actually been isolated and studied, but there are hundreds of thousands of genes, and that's what makes up, of course, that's the reason for the incredible diversity in the human family throughout the years. Chromosome is a larger unit. There are 46 chromosomes in a human cell, and chromosomes carry the genes. Okay, in a sperm, there is a single chromosome. There are single chromosomes. In an ovum, there are single chromosomes. When the sperm and the ovum come together, the chromosomes pair. And so every single human cell in the body carries 46 chromosomes. Those chromosomes carry hundreds of thousands of genes. And it essentially works, as Mendel said it worked 100 years ago, and you know about dominant recessive traits, etc. Every bit of information that goes into manufacturing or making who you are and who I am is contained in every cell of the body. And one of the great mysteries that no one knows anything about, as far as I know, is a phenomenon known as differentiation. That is to say, in the first cell that was you or that was I, there was only one cell, 46 chromosomes, but all the information that makes up our total cells was there. That one cell divides into two, and becomes the zygote goes into a blastocyst and all this business, and very, very soon, differentiation begins to occur. And finally there gets to be a spinal column and arms and legs and heart, and all that comes out of the same chromosomes, but no one knows why, instead of just becoming a great big spherical shmoo, undifferentiated shmoo, we become a differentiated body, so that there's some kind of something that triggers the differentiation of those genes. But all the information is in every single cell. Okay, now, when cells combine, the chromosomes are constantly splitting and combining. That's where recombinant DNA research comes from. That's where the term comes from. Constantly combining, and the vast 99.99999% of the cases, the code is copied precisely. That's simply incredible. But it is virtually always copied precisely. Once in a great while, there's a mistake in the copying. It doesn't copy exactly. That's called a mutant, okay? And it's been happening for billions of years, and continues to happen, and the vast majority of those mutants do not survive, okay? They simply die. They aren't able to make it. Once in a great, 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 great while, a mistake in the copying happens to be a good mistake, okay, in terms of evolution, and it provides some kind of trait for the organism that allows it to survive in a way in which it was not able to survive before. And as environments change, of course, the kinds of traits that are helpful also change, and that's what evolution is all about. Evolution is about recombining DNA. That's precisely what it's about. It's about mutants, mutations that occur from time to time. Okay, what recombinant DNA technology is about is doing in the laboratory what has been done in nature for lo these many years. What it's about is doing on purpose what has been done at random all these years. What it is about is speeding up and specifying, I suppose, almost infinitely, a process that has been going on since God created the world. I suppose maybe some kind of analogy would be the computer. The computer is not something brand new. The brain has been doing those kinds of things all these years, but the computer does it incredibly faster and on purpose and specifically. Okay. Basically, as I understand it, the technology involves a bacterium is a one-celled organism. It's a one-celled organism that reproduces by simply splitting in two. It reproduces asexually rather than sexually. And a bacterium is very useful for these people because it's simple to work with. And if you take a bacterium, you have, let's say, a chromosome, but there is a special bacterium, it's called Escherichia, I don't know if somebody can pronounce that better than I, coli, and the short name for that is E. coli. If you've read any of this literature, you're talking about E. coli all the time. E. coli is a bacterium. It is extremely common. It lives in the intestines of human beings and, I guess, most mammals. An extremely common organism, readily available, and in addition to the chromosome, which is the basic carrier of DNA materials, it happens to have smaller little pieces of DNA, and those things are called plasmids. A plasmid is a very, very short hunk of DNA. They have found out that it's possible to work with these plasmids by introducing, in the first place, you put that into some kind of juice and throw it into a centrifuge and you break down the outer lining of the cell. So you get those plasmids somehow free from the membrane. Then by introducing an enzyme, and an enzyme is a little bugger that that triggers chemical reactions in the cell. The DNA carries the code, but the enzyme is kind of the foreman. Okay, the DNA is the plant manager, the enzyme is the foreman, and the enzyme says, okay, we'll carry out the DNA's instructions. So they get these plasmids, these short hunks of DNA, and introduce an enzyme, which is called a restriction enzyme, which takes that plasmid and breaks it down in a nifty way so that there is a nice little piece that's cut out of the plasmid. And along with that little piece go, of course, genes. Huh? I don't know how many, but some genes. Not so many, I think. Not so many. Maybe what, Fred? 10 or something? Five, okay, 5 or 10. Hundreds of thousands in our body, genes. Well, you can get that plasmid down with E. coli so that you cut out 5 to 10 genes or something like that. In a nice, nice little hunk there. That's done by a restriction enzyme. Then you take another enzyme, which is called ligase or something. I've never heard it pronounced. I just read it. And that can introduce the this plasmid into another, and I'm not sure at this moment whether it introduces it into another plasmid, I think into a chromosome. Into a chromosome, which has the same, it's like a plug in the wall, huh? So that it fits exactly, and there are, they call them sticky edges, and that enzyme glues them together. So that you get this little piece, see, into the chromosome, and what you do is to introduce new genes into that chromosome. And you create an organism that perhaps has never existed in the history of the world. Now, of course, that's happening in nature all the time, huh? By those mutations, by those mistakes in the copying of the code. But now you can do it in the laboratory, you can do it on purpose, and you can do it with incredible speed. Okay? That is known as recombinant DNA research. And the chromosome then, back into the bacterium cell, reproduces itself, and not this chromosome, but the new chromosome reproduces itself. And so you can produce then a new bacterium, a new E. coli, in what, 30 minutes or something, and by exponential growth, you can have billions of those things in no time flat. Genetic engineering, as I understand it, is a much broader word than recombinant DNA research. Recombinant DNA research has to do with recombining DNA. Genetic engineering is a very, very broad term, but it has been brought much closer to reality by the synthetic manufacture of a gene that is biologically active. This happened as late as last year. I have an article here in The New Scientist that is done by Karama at Harvard. Pardon me, Harvard or MIT, I think he's at MIT. He has manufactured a gene, synthesized the gene in the laboratory. So if you can manufacture genes, and then you can recombine DNA molecules, genetic engineering is now actually a possibility. Okay? Now that's just something about the technical scientific aspects of that.
Isn't it still a certain matter of chance, though? I mean, in terms of,
yes,
we really haven't got the tool at this point in time to do it on purpose. It's
right, which is one of the ethical problems. Right. Another problem is that not only don't they have the tools to do that precisely, you know, we don't even know that much about genes. We know practically nothing about genes. But in order to speed up the experimentation process, many people are using what they call shotgun procedures, which is, instead of the slow process of worrying about those 4 or 5 genes, you just throw a whole bunch of stuff and and shake it up and see what happens. it's highly successful. I think I read an article about one guy who has actually isolated something like 46 genes and studied them, and he's got that down cold now, what those 46, and that came about through shotgun recombinant DNA technology. Okay, back in 1971, something about the public policy questions, the public interest questions. Back in 1971, there was a conference out at Coldwater Laboratories, or whatever it's called, out in Long Island, where James Watson, DNA guy, is now chief honcho. There was a meeting out there specifically about how to handle dangerous biological research. some guy from Stanford, I think he was a lab assistant or something like that, was talking to a guy, Coldwater, and started talking about an E. coli experiment that was going on out at Stanford. This guy, Long Island, got excited about that. He got on the phone, called up a fellow by the name of Paul Berg at Stanford, who was doing this E. coli research. And they talked on the phone. Berg says, no problem at all. He said, we're doing it all the time. But they talked a while. He said, well, maybe we better hold off for a while. There were a number of meetings that followed. There was one in New Hampshire in 1973 of scientists discussing the dangers of the thing. And that led to a now famous meeting at Asilomar down the Monterey Peninsula in 1975. The chairman was Paul Berg of Stanford University. It was made up almost entirely of scientists. There were, I think, four lawyers and a few newspeople. Almost entirely scientists. And they were talking basically about whether they ought to continue with this kind of stuff. Most of them said, of course. It happened to be a speech by the husband of Maxine Singer, who is a biochemist for the National Institute of Health, who started talking about legal aspects of recombinant DNA research and said, you people are really courting trouble. Someone in your laboratory is going to get some infectious disease and die, and his family or her family is going to sue you for $18 zillion or something. Also, all kinds of other illegal, and so they got worried. They drafted then a kind of a moratorium statement, and very fascinating reading about meetings like this. It's almost like reading about the Council of Nicaea. Yeah. You get into theology or science or any other field, and as long as there are human beings doing it, it's going to be a very human process, okay? And so they're working through the night, they're counting votes. Paul Berg decided we can't let this come to a vote because we'll lose. He was positive that the scientists would vote it down. Through an interesting combination of factors, pardon me?
You mean vote the moratorium?
Yes, yes. It was brought up and it did pass. So but this was a private group, had no official status. But it hit the newspapers like crazy. Scientific American, for instance, when they came out this year with their article, entitled it something like, When the Scientists Fear Science. Or something like that. Lots of titles like that. And everybody said, wow, if the scientists are scared, we better be scared too. So then there got to be stuff fed into local governments, the mayor of Cambridge, the city council decided that recombinant DNA research would not be done at Harvard or MIT. Big, big, long battles about that happened in San Diego, Madison, Wisconsin. All kinds of local jurisdictional groups were fighting this. The National Institutes of Health came out then with some guidelines. They are only guidelines. They are not necessarily even enforceable. The article in Scientific American is written by a person who spent, 84 days or something in a lab in Stanford, and says she's simply amazed at the delight in which the people in the laboratory took in avoiding the guidelines. I mean, they're eating their sandwiches there at the counter and just, that kind of an attitude. Bernard Davis of Harvard University, biochemist, who is a great proponent of DNA research, says that he'll drink it. He'll drink DNA. He'll drink recombinant DNA by the glassful anytime anybody wants. It's absolutely, totally safe. They're nuts to it. So there's a big question about the enforceability of those guidelines. There is also the problem that it affects not only the academic community, but commercial interests. One of the major aspects of recombinant DNA research is commercial, and so the drug houses, General Electric, all kinds of people are at work on recombinant DNA research, and how those guidelines apply is a big question. That's why these bills have come before Congress and they won't be voted on until fall, but they have to do with regulating the research. Okay, I'm going to start to wind down here.
You're doing great.
one of the huge problems for the public, and one of the huge problems for the church as a witness within the public arena, is that it is incredibly difficult to sort out the voices from the scientific community, because there are angry and loud voices on both sides of the issue. And I have a bunch of quotations here, but I won't scurry around to try to find them, but it is really something. For instance, the person who was head of the committee for the formulating of the NIH guidelines is a fellow by the name of David Hognes, I think his name is, who happens to be one of the big shotgun DNA researchers. Some people think that's entirely appropriate. Of course, the guidelines should be done by someone who knows something about it. Another person who is himself engaged in DNA technology says, this is the first time in history when incendiaries have been hired to form their own bucket brigade. These are not people who don't know anything. These are people who are themselves engaged in the research. Another guy said it's like having General Motors write the law for seatbelts. So, you know, who governs whom? Who regulates whom? How does the public interest get expressed? How does public policy get written? Who does it? It gets to be a major issue. So that a fellow by the name of Shargraff, who is a molecular biologist, says, absolutely no, stop, finished, no more. Future generations will curse us, all kinds of big things like that. And you have Bernard Davis on the other hand saying, what are you talking about? Give me a glass of it, I'll drink it this afternoon. So it's very hard to sort out all that. Okay, some issues, and I'm just going to list some things. And Dave can come, we have some. One issue is cost-benefit analysis. That's kind of like making good mistakes. Very difficult because the information is so hard to get at. But there are enormous benefits possible. You maybe saw a couple of weeks ago where someone, I think it was at Stanford again, or was it the University of California, was out in your area there somewhere anyway, had actually succeeded in manufacturing a bacterium that would produce insulin. That's one of the expected outcomes, so that instead of going around getting pancreases from slaughtered pigs, you could actually set up bacteriological factories to produce insulin. Also clotting factors for hemophilia. There is talk about the fact that there are bacteria in some plants that fix nitrogen from the air. So that instead of worrying about nitrogen in the soil, you could produce a bacterium that would fix nitrogen from the air and put that into the plants, and you wouldn't have to fertilize because you could, the plant could suck that nitrogen out of the air. It would increase productivity enormously. It is possible, maybe, to take and manufacture by a bacterium that would, for instance, split off the hydrogen from the oxygen in a water molecule, and that's a possibility for unlimited energy. There are various photosynthesis kinds of processes which would make possible the manufacture of protein and unlimited amounts of food virtually. There are people who talk about manufacturing a bacterium that would eat up oil spills, because bacteria are the essential agents for decay, and they're kind of scavengers. And you could do something that would not only eat up the oil, but which could turn it into food to eat. The potential, the possibilities are simply enormous. The hazards, of course, are also enormous. And one of the problems is that one of these new little creatures would somehow get out. And no one has any idea what that might be or what it might do. And so the various regulative procedures that have been suggested are grouped under physical containment and biological containment. Physical containment means things like airlocks. It means things like washing your hands. It means things like not eating peanut butter sandwiches over the lab counter. It means all kinds of things like that. And there are four levels in the NIH guidelines on physical containment: P1, P2, P3, P4, where P1 is the least dangerous, P4 is the most dangerous. And there are only at the present time two P4 labs in the United States, one in Bethesda, Maryland, which happens to be in a trailer parked on a side street in Washington. Some people think, wow, you know, we could do better than that. The other P4 facility that's being developed is at Fort Derrick, Maryland, which happens to be a converted germ warfare laboratory. And that gives some people the heebie-jeebies, because, of course, one of the hazards of the thing is that there are unlimited possibilities also for germ warfare. And as we know, the government always doesn't always tell us what it's doing. And so somehow or another, one has to work on that cost-benefit analysis. There's a question of academic freedom. The academics are saying, hey, this is, you know, back to the Middle Ages if you won't let us seek knowledge. Other people say, hey, there's a difference between thinking and doing. You can think anything you want. When you start doing something, the public is involved. There's a question of the burden of proof. A lot of people assume the burden of proof is, of course, on those who say we can't do it. But now there's a whole new generation of scientists who say, no, the burden of proof is on those who say we should do it. That has something to do with Dave's a graph that you saw yesterday. I read an article that talks about the ignorance explosion. And it's exactly what Dave was talking about, the ignorance explosion. And they talk about the increased ratio of noise to signal. So that what we have is a lot of noise, but it's not information. Because information has to be decoded noise, has to be a clear signal. What we have is like listening to a radio with all static. And so the ignorance explosion is enormous, and so there are people who are saying the burden of proof lies on those who say we should do it, not on those who don't. Well, of course, that's an enormous question, upon whom the burden of proof is. There are people who talk about the ethics of long-range responsibility. That's a kind of a new kind of talk. Isaac Asimov, in the Saturday Evening Post article, winds up by saying, I won't read it, but he's all for it. He says, wow, the benefits far outweigh the dangers. In another article that I read, Asimov says, well, I don't really care. We'll all be dead anyway before they produce it. Lord Keynes, the economist, said about the long run, in the long run we'll all be dead. There are people who don't give a rip about the long run, but it seems to me Christians specifically do have a stake in the long run, and the ethics of long run responsibility again has something to do with making good mistakes, has something to do with feedback devices, has something to do with scenarios of the future, and so on. There are those who talk about the question of forbidden knowledge. There are some who say, it's better not to know. And others say, what? It's always better to know. That's a tricky question. It's a tricky theological question. It has something to do with faith and doubt. There's a question of scarce resource allocation. The fact that DNA, recombinant DNA research happened, is due to the fact that after World War II, there were enormous amounts of money put into medical research that was supposedly going to cure cancer, stroke, etc. As a matter of fact, what's happened is recombinant DNA technology. How do you allocate? How do you allocate public funds and for what? I guess that I will just stop. I think that the question of a basic optimistic or pessimistic stance toward life. We're talking about that yesterday too. I guess that Dolores was reading me some marvelous stuff from G.K. Chesterton on optimism and pessimism. He says the pessimist is the cosmic anti-patriot. The optimist has supernatural loyalty to things. I think that's right. I buy that. And I think the Christian, again, is, I would say, a creative, moderate, qualified optimist. He's not, or she is not a naive optimist, but a creative, moderate, qualified optimist. I guess that the theological, the ethical issues that we've been talking about these last 2 days are perhaps sufficiently obvious in this whole mess, and it's too late, and I just quit.
Okay. I'll add just a few notes. I mean, I think you've done a very good explain it far more than I understand about it. I think very good. I'll just add a few notes. The discussion that has occurred here and that you do find in the literature tends to be more on the more microbiologist and molecular biologist. Some of the concerns about the dangers come from the ecologist, who look at a much broader view. And from an ecological standpoint, the fact that you're doing these things at a short time scale is very significant. Because on a long time scale, what you have is mutual adaptation, you know, through evolution. That as something new comes out, the other things adapt to it. You have mutual adaptation in terms of the interaction between species and systems of species, between hosts and predators and prey and so forth and so on. But when you go fast, you don't have that system's mutual adaptation. And so you end up with something that just doesn't fit in the rest. It's a fairly simple way of saying it, simply because there hasn't been the time to do that. An example of that would be the development of chlorinated hydrocarbons, chemicals, which has some similarity to this, except the difference is that when you develop a chlorinated hydrocarbon, a new chemical compound, it doesn't have the potential to reproduce itself. Whereas this seems to have the potential to reproduce itself, so it's scarier. It can explode more.
You mean like DDT?
Like DDT being an example. And what we have found in the case of chlorinated hydrocarbons like pesticides, there are very few of them that have developed through the evolutionary process, very few natural ones. And so you end up with totally new chemical compounds that get spread, and the system just doesn't adapt to them very well. And we find that there's ecological problems and human health problems. Some of the cancer that we have may be related to these new chemical compounds and new things that have not been part of our history, our genetic history, our evolutionary history, so our bodies do not have the capacity to adjust and adapt to them, and so we get disorder. And of course, I guess maybe that's what cancer is, kind of a spreading disorder, because it just can't fit it all together.
Disorder from within.
From within, yes. And some of the ecological problems that we have are kind of fit into that, kind of a disorder. The system kind of functions together more, and now you throw in some new chemical compounds, and it begins to get some sort of disorder. So if we're going to talk about the risk, we cannot limit it to the molecular biologist, and we have got to bring in people who take a broader view, namely the ecologist, which raises a very difficult problem that they think very differently. The molecular biologist and the ecologist think very differently, and the communication becomes extremely difficult. I have been a participant in one of the Asilomar conferences, and they are amazing. I mean, you really come away realizing, of course, you shouldn't be surprised that the science is a very human enterprise. And all of the kinds of conflicts and power plays and things that you see at a religious convention or something else, they happen there also. It's a very dynamic kind of interaction. The particular one that I went on had to do with the chemical compounds. It did not have to. So we had to deal with some of the how to test for ecological impacts the whole variety of chemical compounds that were being produced. What happened, I'll give you a little insight into the conference. The conference came out with just a feeling, overwhelming feeling of the magnitude of the problem. You figure out the number of combinations that you can get of these chemical compounds, and it's just enormous. I mean, it's just enormous. And just kind of a feeling that we can do some good things, but compared to the magnitude of the problem, we just don't know where to go. But when it actually came down to writing the work, and particularly with the National Science Foundation people who pass out grants kind of standing around there, people became very positive about what they were doing in their particular area. And we had other people in government agencies continually saying, well, let's not sound too pessimistic. Let's not sound... And so the report came out sounding better than the discussion came out. The people at NSF saw this. In fact, there was some of it in terms of, there was one character there, that any time a topic came up, what was important, he would talk about his particular research project. And no matter what the topic was, in fact, in the end, the guy who was directing this, who I knew fairly well, the guy who was directing this, finally at the end, he was getting frustrated. So he said, I want people now, we'll have a couple hours, for people to go on out and say what they learned at this workshop that they didn't know before they came here. And this guy stood up and he spoke, one of the things I learned is the importance of, and then he goes out and tells his topic. Well, the people from NSF, I think, recognize this, and I came back, I went to Washington and I met with a fellow. He says, you know, that conference was really something. He says, since that conference where we had the guidelines, we've been searching around to give grant money to try to wrestle with a problem, and we haven't been able to find. We haven't been able to find out how to deal with the problem. We did get that, not the graph, but the concept in the introduction of that report. So I guess the two things that I'd like to say, first of all, the problem is much more than one of molecular biology. So we cannot simply say, let the molecular biologist make the decision. It's much more than that. It involves many, many kinds of scientific disciplines and many ethical concerns, and I really congratulate you for getting into this area. I mean, this is a rarity to have someone actually do that. Because it's really a joy to see you doing that. Because these are the kinds of questions that you raise that have to be addressed. Because in general, a specific discipline will look at their particular work, and they will go through quite a few gyrations and arguments to try to support their doing it. And so we need that kind of dialogue from different disciplines. And the problem, I don't have any answers to it. It is an enormous problem, both ethically and scientifically, as far as I can see. And how we make decisions on this, I'm really not sure. I'd like to say, though, that experts are needed, but not just experts. I mean, not just experts, particularly in science, because experts are geared to making conclusions. And I think most of them would say, if you can't prove to me that I shouldn't do it, I should do it. And it becomes almost impossible to prove that there will be a certain kind of problem. So I think with those kind of footnotes, I just assume if you want to add anything else, then let's open
it
up.
No, let's open.
I've read a few of the articles that you referred to, but in talking with people about it, the average layman, it seemed to me, seemed to think that what they were doing in these test tubes was getting ready to manufacture people.
Right.
And then, you know, they really got upset. I hadn't heard anyone discuss possibility of disease or the possibility of something escaping that would change the whole chemical foundation of all kinds of different things. But they were afraid that they were going to be replaced by a test tube.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there any possibility of that?
Way, way, way down the pike, I suppose cloning people is now theoretically possible, whereas before now, it was only science fiction. So it's not an entirely stupid worry, but the technology is, you know, they'll have to advance, I don't know, by a factor of, 100 or something before that could ever be possible.
Well, is all they're worried about is disease and changing the basic chemistry of things
I was going to make the point, you know, that changing disease is really a major thing to worry about. You know, I agree with a lot with Dave that if you look at the history, I think, of any type of biological manipulation, I think, you know, we know so little about ecology, but almost every experiment where a new animal particularly, but many times even new plants have been introduced within the globe in places where they previously hadn't been, they've almost always ended up in a disaster, or they've had, certainly they've all had negative implications which were not anticipated for the reason that they did it. I mean, just invariably. When you think about
on a small scale, that's why when we go to Mexico, we get Montezuma's revenge, right? Or Delhi Valley in India, or whatever.
They found out that polio was even the same way. That the polio virus never was caused in tropical climates, because there they had a kind of bacteria in their colon that gave them a natural resistance to it, and it had to do with their poor sanitation. So our susceptibility to polio was due to our good sanitation. We had to come up with a vaccine for it. You know, the things where they introduce a new bird in a different area, they try and manipulate to where they live. There always ends up being a disaster.
Isn't that true? The sickle cell disease in blacks is because they're in a new environment, and that particular in West Africa was a very healthy thing.
Healthy
they move here and sickle cell disease.
That it was unhealthy.
Yeah.
That's right. So when you know that history, you know, our knowledge is so small, I think it's very frightening to think about introducing new kinds of biologicals into our ecosystem, etc. No matter what the positive potential values of them are, so I'm really afraid of that. I have another
question.
But
couldn't that be said about almost any kind of pure research?
Well, it could certainly when people started coming up with nuclear theories. I mean, I don't think they necessarily anticipated all the bomb. Although maybe that was the reason that they did it too. I mean, there was some of that going back and forth, but. You're right in the sense that it's maybe no worse than the fact that we have the potential to destroy the Earth right now with nuclear energy.
Well, I mean,
we
could have stopped research on penicillin. You know, here was this accident thing. Nobody knew what it was.
Yeah, but I don't think anybody had the implications at that time that it was something that could potentially destroy the world. In other words, this is...
Well, we didn't know what it was. It was an accident.
Well, just look at, for instance, all
this isn't an accident. It's a planned accident.
Any of them are from research that have come that we consider good, like factories and all that stuff, you know?
But this is a different kind of research. We're not saying we're against research, and I'm not against the whole idea of it, but I'm saying, but by golly, there ought to be some... cautions. I think your criticism of the community in terms of saying, hey, what did you say about the incendiaries?
Forming their own fire brigade.
Forming their own fire brigade. On the other hand, the impetus to put limitations on this came out of the people doing it. Now, not all of them, but that in and of itself tells you something. I mean, and it's healthy. I mean, they should be congratulated that they brought up the issue. Now, they may not have had the same implications.
Or the same motives.
Now the other people have become scared and they want to limit them.
Right.
But it was basically good. And if the people into it themselves, like you say, they're narrow, they're really focused, they have all these other motivations for continuing it. If they are even a little scared, that scares me a lot.
And maybe we ought to announce that we're going to run maybe another 10 minutes, but we'll make some kind of formal break so that people can get coffee in a little while.
Right.
Yes.
The invention or the discovery of penicillin by the lady mentioned here has radically shifted the whole medical profession's ability to handle disease and the whole public's demand that we have instant cure and you guys have the answer.
I mean, if it's voluntary, then good guys come in last, and the people who don't have the ethical concerns will do it rather than the people who do. If there isn't some sort of broad coercion to go ahead and enforce the standards, they won't be enforced, and the only broad base that we have for doing that is government.
One of the big questions that arises is also, of course, the global dimension.
Sure.
It's one thing to control it in this country, but what do you do globally?
What do you do in Russia or Liberia?
I haven't really heard any Christian comments about this whole thing. And in my layman and ignorant way, I've been thinking about it for several years, ever since I first heard about all of this. And I've come to the conclusion God created all of this. God knew what he was doing. It's all been here. All we're doing is discovering it. And I feel that God is letting us know more as we become better able to handle it. I don't think we have to worry too much about it.
That's a very interesting, pardon me, Dave, it's a very interesting comment. Can I say just a little? Because what I thought you were going to say when you began was the opposite.
That's right.
What I thought you were going to say is that God made it all, he created it all, and so we had better not tamper with it. But you went in exactly the opposite direction, and I think that's possible. And I think it's very, very interesting that one can do that. And that does not mean that the premise is unimportant. The premise is terribly important, but Christians are going to talk with one another in detail about which one of those directions they take. And so a lot of stuff gets fed into the discussion.
I think history may not bear your conclusion out, though,
yeah.
Because God has allowed us to learn most research from a historical point of view, most research that has continued is out of a position of crisis. And most crises seem to emerge out of human conflict, in other words, war. And the technological advances, most of our benefits have been medical, communications, physics, and physics, etc., have been offshoots from research because of the need to build a better technology to beat the other guy. And God has allowed us to learn in many areas, but we seem to continue to misuse what he has allowed us to learn. We have continued to hit each other over the heads with this knowledge. So I'm not so sure that, I hope that you're right, but I think history has proven this possibly to be not true.
He's given us the knowledge to kill ourselves, hasn't he? I mean, he's allowed us to have that, but hasn't he also given us the wisdom to maybe not lead us to that end result, okay?
As Christians, yes.
We're not getting at this all at one time. It's taking a little...
Sure, it's taking time, but that doesn't mean the end result has to be necessarily
positive.
Faith
in the technology.
See, it depends. What I'm concerned about is you're still looking at science as saying that you're discovering God's creation, okay, and reality. Okay, and that he's got it all set out and all we have to do is discover. But what if we only discover things that lead to negative implications before we lead to the things that have positive implications? Then there's a whole different way of looking at it and saying that every time you come up with these scientific discoveries, you're in fact not necessarily discovering God's creation, but changing the reality of what's there. This Watson and Crick thing, I mean, genes and chromosomes have been around since matter was created, and this whole business about the double helix, like you said, they had to do that by theory. It was theory before it was ever found. They'd have never found it if they hadn't come up with a theory.
What I'm saying is...
And the theory had altered the reality.
What I'm saying is...
If they had a different theory, they may have found a different thing.
We use we use what we have discovered. God has given us dominion over this planet, and we continue to learn about this planet, which entails everything, the physical laws down to this actual physical structure of what's going on. We continue to misuse what God has given us. We are beginning to realize just in the past 5 or 10 years how our misuse of the environment alone is going to continue to cause us problems, and we're getting to a point where we may not be able to backtrack.
I'm gonna make two quickies and we're gonna break for coffee. I think it was also a very interesting thing that you said. I may not be quoting you exactly, that you haven't heard a Christian thing being said. Now, I realize that you meant a specifically Christian thing. That's an interesting thing that we could talk about for a long time. What is a Christian thing to say? I think that Dave and I think that everything that we're doing, everything that we're saying, is a Christian thing because it's Christian people who are saying it. It's like Paul saying, everything done of faith, or sin is everything that's not done in faith. So that when one approaches problems as Christian, one is in a way saying Christian things, I think. At least that would be another maybe position. The second thing that I want to say is simply to come clean with where I am at the moment, and that is, and I guess maybe a good many of us are there, I cannot see the possibility or the desirability of a total ban on recombinant DNA research. I simply can't see that, but I am for enormously tight controls, and exactly what those are requires some fine-tuning of the whole public policy process. Thank you very much.
Thank you.